I'm on a mission to cut through the noise and the nonsense to bring you the very best information from the most authentic spiritual experts on the planet. Okay, so hi everyone. I'd like to welcome Freddie Silva onto the show today. Freddie is a best-selling author, a researcher, and a filmmaker. So hi Freddie, how are you?
Hello. Hello, England.
England, yeah.
From the other side of the world. Well, across the pond anyway.
Yeah. Okay, so 2020, it's been a bit of a weird year for a lot of people. Lots of people are questioning things, and we're sort of maybe collectively having a bit of an existential crisis. So when I read your book, Missing Lands, I just thought, wow, if more people knew this, things would change. So what is it that is driving you to do this work?
Boredom and curiosity is a very dangerous combination.
Yeah.
No, I have always been even from a very young age, I never really sat well with the information that was being given to me or spoon-fed me. And I always had a curiosity about what's the other side of the story. I mean, it's almost like being in a relationship. You have to learn to look at the other person's point of view to get a bigger picture. And I spent a lot of the years in industry, in advertising and design and photography. All those moments where I was laid off or actually fired for having a conscience, I realized that my heart was somewhere else. And I really want to go and study pyramids and the ancient past, because therein lies the answer to so many of the paradoxes that we face with today. And I just took a big leap of faith, and my first book was an international bestseller, so I couldn't ask for anything better than that. And I just kept going for 20 years, and it seems to get better and better. So I've obviously touched on something which is very sort of primordial within people, because I get a lot of feedback from people saying this has really helped me figure out what to do in my life, because there's so much that's in the ancient past that is relevant to us now. And I thought, yes, there is. It's the reason why they built big temples to last thousands and thousands of years. They could have used bricks, but they didn't. They used big stones in order to make sure that this stuff survived. And I think they could foresee a time when we began to lose the plot. I mean, really lose the plot. And so they built these self-help centers around the world where we sort of go back there. And if you just happen to be open and travel to these places, and England, of course, is packed with these places, you get a sense that you're much more connected to things. And that's that connection that gives you the answers that you're looking for. So in a way, it was a kind of a therapeutic thing for me, but also a therapeutic thing and a self-help thing for many people around the world. So it's been absolutely great fun.
Amazing. So how old is humanity really? So where was the first civilization and how advanced was it?
Oh my God, that's three big questions.
Sorry.
Every single week there's another revelation, another lucky turn of the spade reveals yet another Homo sapiens skeleton that's pushing the dates further and further back. We had people at skeletons in Morocco going back to 300,000 years. Now we're in Bulgaria at 400,000. Now Greece is 500,000. China now is 600,000. It keeps expanding and going back and back and back. And it reminds me of a quote that an Egyptian priest was telling to a visiting Greek historian about 2,500 years ago. And they were admonishing the Greeks, saying, you know, you people, you're too young. When you've been around as long as the Egyptians have, you get to see everything. At one point, the earth was actually upside down. There was indescribable cold. We survived incredible cataclysms, and we wrote down every notable event that came to our ears on the walls of our temples. And humanity's been around forever, they said. But the problem is that every once in a while, there's a periodic collapse of the entire ecosystem, and also meteorites coming and hitting the earth, and all the old faces of civilization are effaced, they said. Right. And we have to start again like children. And the trick is, we've maintained the oral traditions, written them down, in order so that we don't have to start like children again. We have a barometer to go back to and say, hey, they've gone through this. How can we improve our chances of survival and not starting from scratch again? Yeah. And if you look at the Indian texts and compare them to the Egyptian, they even go a stage further, because they talk about times when God is a strange word. People seem to equate God with some kind of ethereal, non-physical form, but a god was nothing more than a law of nature. So a desk has a god, a plant has a god, a wall has a god. And if you acquire the understanding of what that god does, that spirit of that form does, you become as a god. So you had these god people that sort of, that lived for 800 years back in the day, which covers a huge range. Yeah. And some of their calendars and some of their king lists go back 140,000 years in that part of the world. So they still have the memory, the historical memory of going back to a certain time when people were moving through the sky with strange craft, which NASA has taken a look at. And they said, actually, when you look at the description and the diagrams, these things actually could fly. And there's so many stories in the Pacific, in islands. And I remember there was some places in Polynesia, the first white people show up about 300 years ago. And the native people said they were totally incredulous that these white people didn't believe that things could levitate. You couldn't levitate big rocks and put them where you wanted, or people couldn't fly. They didn't understand that. And Europeans were like, what are they smoking? So when you read these stories, it turns out that they had complete control over the laws of nature. That's the one thing that defines all the gods in the old stories. They understood nature, they could control it, manipulate it to their own devices. And one of them was taking the idea that you could actually, you know, do this, and you defy gravity, and they could move around from A to B. In Japan, they had the flying rock boats. You can still see some of them on the side of Mount Miwa in southern Japan, massive monoliths carved like laser beams. So there was a technology for certain, and it was based on natural principles, and we don't know where it went. Sometimes we find vestiges of it, all petrified bits, you know, like strange things that are found under the North Sea, for example, 3 miles in the coal seam on the North Sea, strange objects made of metal that shouldn't be there. I mean, that's 3 million years old coal on the North Sea. How the hell did it get there? So once in a while, the Earth gives up its history, and we realize, actually, things have been here before. The trick is not to judge it by our own barometer. Yeah. You know, we look at, they didn't have computers, so they couldn't have been that developed yet, but they would also argue that by having computers today, we've lost our connection to the outdoors. We've lost our connection to reality. And so many people are sitting there doing this every day, and they have no idea where to go shop for bread if their cell phone goes down.
Yeah.
So I would say, from their point of view, we've actually gone backwards. But yet we look at ourselves and we're very technologically proficient. So it depends on where your point of view is. That's the most important thing.
Do you think that we'll ever find that again? Will we ever find that connection?
I think we will. I think we're going back to it. I mean, look at what's happening right now with the whole COVID thing. They did a test where 23 people in a survey said, we're not going to go back to that life again. We're not going to commuting to London for 4 hours a day. Why should we? And I think people are beginning to recognize the idea of fresh air, fewer vehicles on the road. Even here in America, where I live right now, I have taken a few flights and contributed to the carbon footprint, unfortunately, but that's my job, unfortunately. I wish there were more high-speed trains. And I've flown over Lake Michigan, which is usually this brown, turgid thing. It was turquoise blue. Mm-hmm. And for once, in 20 years, I could actually see Chicago from a plane. I mean, every building, every window, it was so clear. The sky is a beautiful blue where I live. And you realize, actually, we've been missing something. While we're trying to make a lot of money, we've missed out on something. So I think that these moments of calamity actually do help reset human consciousness to another paradigm. As to whether we'll go back and rediscover what the ancients had, I don't think so. Because every technology has its own particular limit. I mean, let's say for the sake of argument that the ancients did understand the process of levitation and anti-gravity, which to all intents and purposes, if you read all the stories, they did. And if we gave that technology today to the construction industry, you would have a hotel, I guarantee, all the way from Cornwall, all the way along the coast, all the way up to Northern Scotland in a day, because you could move the bricks through the air, boom, boom, like that. And you'd be putting these things up in the blink of an eye, exactly as the ancient people said, the temple of Tiwanaku in Bolivia, the stones moved through the air to the command of sounds, and the temple was built overnight. And you hear that all the time around the world. So I don't think we'll go back to that level of technology. I don't think we have that sort of spiritual wherewithal to be able to control it. We have other technology.
Yeah, absolutely. It might bring house prices down though if we started using that.
God, wouldn't that be? I've always argued that you should first of all get rid of real estate agents because they're the ones driving up the prices because they're getting commission, or just give them a flat fee. They're not living, you give them a flat fee. And if you stop looking at houses and investments rather than places where you should live, you would change the whole focus of what we're doing. One reason why I can't move back to Britain, I can't afford to move back. We were talking about this earlier, it's kind of sad, really.
Absolutely.
But being in America, I'll be able to afford to buy a pub and ship it over, you know.
Do it. So this information that you've been uncovering, has it been deliberately covered up? And is it contested by anyone?
Partly it has, because academia is very conservative. If you look back at, let's say, archaeology, it only started a couple of hundred years ago. And back then, the church was financing a lot of archaeologists because they wanted to prove, without beyond the shadow of a doubt, that the earth was constructed in August the 16th, 4004 BC. So, of course, they discovered dinosaur bones. They've got a bit of a problem because you've got to go from the Big Bang to dinosaurs to Adam in no time at all, and to pyramids. That's a very, very quick development. And they've been sort of working backwards ever since from that. So they're notoriously conservative. They don't want to rock the boat. If they rock the boat and they say something that's not acceptable to the club, and it is a club, by the way, it's a notorious little club, and they will get disowned, they will be dishonored, they will have the weight of all the slander thrown against them, and they're some of the most slanderous people I've ever come across, by the way. Even to me, even on just reviewing books, there's fake reviews on Amazon dissing all my books. And I know who's doing it. It's absolute nonsense. And there's a whole fear that the independent researchers such as myself, who don't belong to the club, we're free to free associate. We're free to read that book, which you shouldn't be reading because it's not part of the accepted academic curriculum. Well, but that book is full of evidence. We should take that evidence for what it is, evidence, and then bring the connections together. And I've taken a couple of people off to the side once in a while, off the record, and they'll confide in me and they say, actually, the information that the independents are coming up with is taking down our ivory towers. And it's actually more coherent than some of our theories because we're constrained within a certain amount of area in order to project certain theories which are not acceptable. It takes years for theories to become acceptable, and only when one of their kind comes up with a theory. So you see how it goes. That's the problem, I think, with the conspiracy theory, is that there is a conspiracy of silence to hold back the information, but at the same time, there's a huge movement in the independent research community bringing out information that has been sitting there all along and it's just been ignored. So there's a bit of both, you see. There's complacency and also exploration going on at the same time. So I prefer the other one because I'm free to read whatever I want. Yeah. And if it makes sense and it's there and it can be proved, then let's stitch the theory together. And tomorrow, if someone unearths something that undermines my theory, I'll say, okay, the theory was good up until this moment. That's what good science is. The theory is good right up to now. That piece of information that I just heard on for today, I can now expand the theory, or I can change the theory altogether or throw it away. Because it was good up to the moment we have this information. With new information, we expand and we learn more. That's actually how you're supposed to be doing it. So, and that's what I do, I hope.
You're chipping away at it and then hopefully kind of.
When you think about it, what we're doing is looking through the garbage heap of history and opening up someone's trash bin and going, oh, what do they have for dinner today? And you look from the contents of all these vegetable peels and you deduce that they're all vegetarians, not just one person, but the whole tribe, the whole region were vegetarians. Well, no, that's complete nonsense. Now, it could be that this person didn't have any meat to eat that week, so they had to go for vegetables. Because you found the vegetable peels, you've assumed that everything in that region, in that era, was run by vegetarians. That's how a lot of academia works, unfortunately. Yeah. So the trick is to sort of take it with a grain of salt and just keep expanding until you come up with more information.
Fantastic. Okay. So knowing what you know, do you consider modern humans to be civilized? And where are we at compared to these pre-flood civilizations that you talk about in your book?
Well, there's a wonderful paradox where if you look back at the stories of the pre-flood gods, so we're now in 12,000 BC, 10,000 BC. This is the moment where the earth gets hit by a third series of meteorites, and the earth has gone into a complete blanket of ice and snow, the Younger Dryas, they call it. And this ice age basically shifted the whole dynamic of everybody on earth to the tropics. Everything was basically covered with ice at both ends. And this is where we get the surviving stories of all the gods. Now, the gods were said to be very tall, 8.5 to 9 feet tall, like the people we have buried in giants' graves throughout Britain and Brittany. And they were red-haired or blonde, light-skinned, and light-eyed, so usually green or blue-eyed, which is very unusual. And they formed a society separate from themselves. They had control of the laws of nature. They were master navigators. They knew everything about mathematics and the stars. And that for them was good enough. They were able to build incredible cities out of massive stones, some of which we can't lift. And there's one in Lebanon, which is now close to 2,000 tons. There is nothing on earth that can lift that rock. So you've got to wonder what kind of technology were they playing with? It was, why not use a brick? It's much easier to move. Well, they did it because they could. They had the understanding. So comparatively, we are actually much, much worse off than today. But also, we are now coming to the same deduction about the universe as the gods used to do. And that is, there's people that I speak with at NASA quite regularly, and they come over and whisper in my ear at conferences. And they come kind of disguised. They don't want to realize. They don't want their peers to know that they're talking to me, a heathen. And they said, you know, it's kind of funny. It's something you wrote in a couple of your books that talks about the how they were so obsessed with the sky. They used to track huge spans of time, which seems a bit over the top for someone who's trying to grow vegetables. All you need to know is what the sun and the moon are doing for the year. That's all. You can do that with sticks in your garden. But no, they had huge calendars that track so many of the planets in the solar system. Why? And the only logical conclusion is they were tracking deep space objects. They wanted to know what was coming out of the sky because they knew that once in a while, some big rocks hit the Earth and that's when the problem happened. Yeah. And they wanted to be prepared. And they're saying, it's funny how now at NASA, every week we have another press release saying, oh, we just missed that rock going by. Yeah. That was a close one, the size of a bus. That would have taken out New York. And so there's a paradox. We are also relatively advanced in our terms, but at the same time, like we said before, we've lost so much of our connection to nature that we're actually at a disadvantage.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's that sort of balance. I think they're a mirror image of ourselves from 12,000 years ago. They could do what we can't, or we can do what they couldn't. And there's the switch, because right now, in the last next 20 years, NASA is saying we actually stand a very high probability of being taken out by a lot of rocks, especially right now at the beginning of November, late October. It's called the Taurid meteor shower.
Right.
That's where the problems come from. Every single time that the Earth has gone through total destruction or near a catastrophe, and the last one was around 2500 BC, by the way, we basically have to start from scratch. So it's interesting that we're now going for the same paradigm of we are facing this total destruction yet again, and we're rushing to find out what to do. And there is an antidote, by the way, in case anybody who's listening, there is an antidote to this. It's in the last chapter of the book, so don't read it first. There is good news. But the idea was that we are now faced with the same problem that the gods had 12,000 years ago. How are we going to get out of it? And I do believe that they set us up in order to figure out how to get out of this for ourselves this time. Last time we had help, and the proof is that we're here. So this time the gods disappeared and they said, it's up to you now to be like us. In fact, be better than us, do better than what we could do. And we're faced with the same paradox. And I find that kind of interesting paradigm that we're facing ourselves with. So let's see how we get out of it. Even mathematicians are saying, yeah, we've calculated that in the next 20 years, there are big chunks in the Taurid meteor shower that do actually stand a big chance of it hitting us again. They did so 12,000 years ago. But like I said, there is an antidote to this. There is a way out of it.
Okay.
I think we'll prevail. I really do think we'll prevail. Because the answer is so easy. It's so simple. It's staring us right in the face. And it's not nuclear missiles.
Okay.
I know you haven't read the last chapter, so I'm not
going to read that. No, I haven't. No. I'm going to read that. So the oldest, the older and the younger dryas, they're quite interesting periods in history. Life would have been very difficult during those times. How could we have advanced so quickly in the sort of brief warm periods? What was going on?
Because the society was already there before that. And I think every surviving culture today that talks about the gods, they do mention that. The Hopi, their traditions still are quite current. They've been processed from one person to the other without losing any of the information. A bit like the Druids in Britain. You'd have to spend 15 years learning the entire history of the Druidic culture in order to become a head Druid. So the Hopi have done the same thing. If you look at their history, it's quite obvious that the people that were here before the three Dryas periods already had the understanding. So every time there was a catastrophe, they'd lose a bit more of the society, the civilization, and then they'll go back almost to caveman-like situations. And they were almost at that point where they were rebuilding in the younger Dryas, which is the third period. This is the moment when the Egyptian gods arrive in Egypt. This is the moment where Viracocha arrives in South America. You know, all the gods that we know of today, they appear suddenly mixing it up with humans because they knew what was coming. They had 800 years from the beginning of the younger Dryas, the start of the Ice Age, to get their act together, to build for another catastrophe that was going to happen, and they knew that someone was going to survive. They were already planning 800 years into the future. So that was what was happening. There was a sort of slow burn of civilization, but they had already inherited everything from a previous culture. And that's what everybody around the world says. There was already many cultures here in the old days. And through catastrophes, they get hard, they get sliced, they get separated. Sea level rises. Most of their lands have gone. We don't see them anymore. They're under the Pacific, they're under the Atlantic. Enough people survived with the understanding to rebuild and put the foundation for the next people to survive the next catastrophe. And that's how they figure, you know, someone's going to survive. We're going to plan forward and just worry. Don't worry about it. Live for today. Do the best you can. And don't worry about the future, because someone's going to die and someone will survive. Guaranteed. That's the way it's always been. There's never really been a golden age. It's always been a golden age. It's just that once in a while, like the surf going in and out, sometimes the surf goes in, sometimes the surf goes out, sometimes there's a big wave. And there's also six waves that you can actually go and surf with, which are much nicer. So this is how they figured. They were very fatalistic, but they were also much more into the moment of living. In fact, the Arabic culture says it quite well, inshallah, as God wills it. We're in the hands of God, but that doesn't mean you sit down and wait for things to happen. You've got to be going out and being proactive. You still get on with your life. And whatever happens, happens. And I kind of like that sort of way of thinking.
Yeah, go with the ebb and flow. Okay, so we've just talked about gods. So do you think they actually were gods, or were they, you know, beings from other planets? Or how would you sort of categorize them?
That's the hard part. I'm currently working on another project, which is a kind of an offshoot from the book, which is like, there's a chapter there that really kind of excited me about the fact that every single god from the old times is associated with Orion. Everywhere you go, Orion is the focus. They came from there. Civilization came from there and came to Earth. Or the gods, when they finish a certain project here, they go back to Orion, not just when they're dead, but when they're alive. And sometimes they would take a lucky human with them to show them their world, to see, hey, this is what you can actually do. You don't have to hang out in caves. You don't have to drag the women by the hair into the caves and eat massive bones and raw. You can cook the food.
And if you want, but you don't have to.
Yeah, you don't have to. If you want to, you can. But here's a better way of living harmoniously. And they'd send them back to Earth, and this person would go back to their peers and say, hey, I've seen a better way of living. And they would become the wisdom keepers of the tribe, or the sages of the tribe. So it seems to me that there was a couple of things going on here. These gods were very much physical. They were very different to us. In fact, there was one culture, and I can't remember who said this, they were human-like, but not quite human. Mm-hmm. Right? Because they were, when you read about them, the humans were not afraid of them. They just said they were very unusual. They were very tall, they had light skin, red hair, not like us. But they felt very comfortable with them. Their offspring, which created huge problems on Earth, when they tried to mate with human women, which created all kinds of problems, least of all because they're twice the height of a human woman, and they gave birth to infants. It killed most of the mothers. It was not working out well. But the infants that survived, they were 40 feet tall, and humans were absolutely afraid of them. They were barbarians, they were murderers, they were completely crazy. There was something about the DNA in the gods that didn't mix with humans. Yeah. They got it right after many thousands of years, but that's another story. And this is where we get the idea of the divine bloodline from. But they basically were able to be in human form whenever they wanted to. That's another story I've also heard. They could take on human form whenever they wanted to. Mm-hmm. As to whether they were aliens or not, we don't know. This is what I'm trying to find out. But there is that stubborn connection with Orion all around the world, even in Pacific islands you've never heard of. Mm-hmm. And it's always the point of civilization, the heart of the sky, the heart of creation. And it's usually not just the Orion itself, it's either the belt stars, which form a kind of portal into their world, and specifically the nebula that sits right between the lower triangle called M42. That's always a spot that they talk about. So it's a work in progress that I'm currently working on to find out what more can we find out about this origin of the gods.
Fantastic.
It also depends on how you view alien, by the way. Little yeah. green men or humanoids. I mean, I'm sure that I've rubbed shoulders with the UFO community quite a bit, and from my understanding, they seem to have as many different types of aliens as we have nationalities on Earth.
Yeah.
So why not? That would make perfect sense. And some of them are a little bit nefarious, and a lot of them are actually good people. They have the gamut as well. So it just depends on the understanding of aliens.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Do you think that there is life out there then, apart from us?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just go and hang out with the Native Americans here. They almost roll their eyes when you say that. It's like, well, why not? They come here for tea every 3 weeks. South Dakota with the Lakota. So, yeah, I mean, we call them the Space Brothers just for fun. They come here with their flying shields. That's what they describe their craft. Yeah. And they're really good people. They taught us the art of civilization, the moral codes by which we live. Yeah. And because we honor them, they communicate with us. They don't go to Washington or Downing Street because they don't trust those people. Yeah. And I think they have a point. They really do. It's about the relationship. And the Zuni, there's a wonderful elder called Clifford Mahuti, who I adore. I spent hours sitting with him and just shutting my mouth and letting him talk, because the stories are incredible. He says it with a lovely straight face. Yeah, I mean, next time you're down in Zuni, come down and we'll go out to one of the canyons and just hang out with some of the lookers. They call them the lookers, otherwise known as the watchers, yeah. Which actually were here in physical form many thousands of years ago. And they said, yeah, I actually brought a guy here from one of my engineering days at NASA, and a big guy with a Ford F-150 truck, you know, I want to see some aliens. And I said, so what happened? And he says, well, we sit there and about 11:30 at night. And when he says that, all the hairs went up on my arms, because that's when all the fun used to happen in Wiltshire when we were looking for crop circles.
Right, okay.
And we have a lot of eyewitnesses that actually see them happening, which is incredible. There's a lot of man-made stuff as well, but it's a real phenomenon too. So I thought, oh, that time, that rings a bell. I said, oh, yeah. And one of the flying shields come in from the valley, and I said, so what happened? She said, well, you've never seen a grown man run so fast in a small truck. Disappears in a cloud of dust, and you never see him again. Back at work, he doesn't even want to talk about it.
Oh.
So, yeah, I think that there's a lot of contact going on. And there's a lot of disclosure already coming out by a lot of countries, like Belgium, Denmark. They've already disclosed and said, yeah, we've been tracking them for generations. What's the problem? They don't mean any harm. I think we'd have been dead by now or in captivity if they meant harm.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very interesting, isn't it? Watch his face. So someone that's got strong religious beliefs, this hidden information, will it compromise what they believe, or can it kind of add to it?
It depends on your religious belief, I think. I think if it's very fundamentalist, it's going to compound the problem, because so much fundamentalism is based on one person's view, usually a guy who hates everything, everybody, especially women. And they formed these books, which became the foundation of this understanding. And then but it bears no resemblance to reality. I mean, if you take the Old Testament, for example, I mean, the people who took the books together, they stole all the information from the Babylonians when they're in captivity in Babylon, to which the Babylonians were really annoyed about. They said, yeah, they just took all our information. They changed the words, they changed the title, they changed the locations, to give the Jewish people sort of, you know, their own particular political grandstanding against all the other people in the area. But then the Babylonians did the same thing anyway, because they took the information from the Sumerians about the flood and all of that, and they changed it to give themselves sort of a greater sort of autonomy over the region, and they were so much more special. So everybody does it. But the Sumerians, if you look back at their information, it's much more consistent and much more close to the truth, because it was handed down for thousands of years. So if you go back to the original stories, it wouldn't shock anybody, because, oh, it's complete proof that, yes, all this stuff actually happened. Yeah. I mean, let's think about it. If these people, according to academia, back 10,000 years ago were cave-like, they didn't get around very much, they were very stupid, and they just wore a little loincloth to protect their dignity. How did they come up with these incredibly elaborate stories with completely developed characters and machines flying through the air and the understanding of the laws of nature, building temple cities and sacred geometry and astronomy and mathematics? Well, that's you can't have both. Either they were not smart or they were really damn smart. You can't have both. So anybody that follows the original track to the beginning of all the books from which most of religions are based on, people will say, actually, that actually makes a lot of sense now. Yeah. Anything that comes from that is just secular religion, which seeks to control people. And if you've noticed, every good religion that actually tries to help people doesn't tell you there's a God out there. It tells you that the God's in here. You are God. You are an expression of that creative source. How can you be separate from what created you? That doesn't make any sense. So any religion that seeks to stifle that connection and short-circuit that connection is telling a great big fib. And then if you want to, if you're confronted with this information that I present, then yeah, they're not going to believe it. It's like voting for Trump, you know. Sorry to bring politics into it, but it's like that. No matter how many of the lies, 22,000 lies that this guy's made in 4 years, and all the nonsense that he's made up, because it's all made up, nothing actually that he's ever done has actually been done. You can put that in front of them and they won't believe it. That's religion. That's just complete, narrow-minded, the lemmings going off the cliff. There's nothing you can do to change those people. So they have a problem with that. Yeah, absolutely. Starting with the fact that if you point out that Yahweh, which is the main God of the Bible, he happened to be the God of war of the Bedouin in the Sinai Peninsula. Now, when you're following the God of war, your religion is not going to end well. And I'm not saying that from an arrogant point of view. It's just a matter of common understanding that if you're following a war god, then that's not going to help you very much. You are not going to be a good person to most people. So, yeah, they will have a problem with this information.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you think that it will ever sort of integrate? Do you think that these sort of programs of control will start to dissolve and that the older information, the original information, will become sort of more accepted?
Oh, I hope so.
Religious context?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I see a lot of it happening on my tours around the world. I speak in places which are very conservative and everybody packs the hall because they don't believe what's going on around, what their neighbors are saying. They just don't want to talk about it because they'll have their cars burnt down. So they keep low profile, but I see a lot of positive things happening around the world, and with the advent of the internet, we much more have a greater access to information, and we also have a lot of access to disinformation. Yeah. You just have to be much more aware. Your wherewithal has to be expanded and more grounded to filter out the nonsense to take in the good information. And of course, nothing beats experience. If you get out there and experience this, you'll see what's right and what's not correct. I see that it will at one point have to come to that, because we can't go on in this black and white division of the world right now. It's really quite crazy. But you know what? Here's the funny thing. I just came back from Egypt. A fantastic tour, by the way. We were the only people there, and we were treated like royalty. It's fantastic. Couldn't get people back on the plane to save your life. Yeah. I said, you know, don't talk to your cell phone while you're here. Get off the damn cell phone. Stop looking at your computer. Get off the internet for 10 days. Yeah, and you paid a fair amount of money to be here with me. I don't even want you to listen to what I have to say. I just want you to be here with the pyramids, with the temples, away from all this nonsense going around you. And in 10 days, I'm going to give you a massive revelation. And they thought I was kind of joking. I said, no, actually, for once, I am not kidding around. 10 days later, we just came back from the pyramids to do a private meditation, for which we paid a lot of money, but it's worth it. Yeah. And I said, right, here's the thing. How stressed are you now from where you were 10 days ago? And they're all kind of just sitting there going, wow, I'm totally relaxed. I'm just so happy. I'm going to change my life. I'm like, exactly. Why? because you've filtered out all the stuff that's around you. It's what you allow into your mind that dictates how you're going to live your day. So yes, COVID is bad. People are dying. That's unquestionable. But there is a way you can actually comport your life in a way that's suitable to yourself while still respecting the fact that people are getting sick. Take basic precautions. Don't go over the top. Like we have here in town. People are eating outside. It's freezing outside. they put them in a plastic bubble.
Right.
Well, why are you stuck in this big plastic bubble where you could be inside the restaurant breathing the same air with the same people? The complete lack of logic to me. Yeah. Just go back to the restaurant while you're inside a plastic bubble, the point is that I think we're reaching a point where we have to sort of go for everything falling away and getting to a point where we're reaching the edge of an abyss in order to understand how close we come to destroying each other and ourselves and a whole planet. And I think at that moment we will awake. Remember about, 10 years ago when the big tsunami hit Indonesia?
Yeah.
8,000 people died. Now, take a step back from that, okay, and on the loss of life, it's horrible. On the bigger picture, if you look back at this, you think, now look at what happened. Look at the positive side of this. 80,000 people gave up their lives to show the rest of the world compassion because all the millions of people that donated £1, £2, £10, $5, send them to Indonesia to help their villages rebuild each other. Why did we do that? We don't know these people. We don't owe them anything. And yet we did that. And at that moment, the world came together to help people on the other side of the world. If you just remember that bit, anytime another calamity comes up in the next year, in the next 5 years, just remember that piece of information because you realize we're actually much closer to reaching that critical moment where we become much more cooperative. Yeah. But sometimes humans are like that. You need to slap them in the face and hurt them until they get it. It's like hurt doesn't work. It's painful. I don't want hurt. I don't like hurt. So why don't I do a better way of living life? And that's how it's going to work. So, and I think we're pretty close to hitting critical mass. We're not that far away. It's just that people who are doing good things, they keep a low profile.
Yeah. We have these opportunities to sort of practice compassion, don't we, on a mass scale quite frequently. And it does seem that way. It does seem that these events open up a lot of stuff. Yeah.
And the Black Death gave rise to the Renaissance.
Yeah.
Every time there's been a major catastrophe anywhere in the world, look at what happens in the next 30 years. Yeah. Great things come out of it. Society degenerates, they become arrogant and complacent, and boom, there's a tide going out again, and then it comes back in. If you look through history, it's always been like this. The trick is, how are you going to deal with it? How are you going to behave, and how are you going to be an example to others?
Yeah.
That's the important thing. You've got to be trying to be a teacher, and don't worry about fixing everything because you can't. You can only take care of your own little patch of land and be the change you wish to see, and someone else will imitate it. That's how you do it. It's the way it's always been done.
Absolutely. So
I probably won't say that after the election in America goes the wrong way, which I hope it won't.
Might not go out till after the election. What belief systems did these pre-flood civilizations have? So did they have religion? Did they have politics? Things like that. Do you know of any evidence to suggest that they did?
They had politics. The gods, they were strange bedfellows. I mean, even the Anunnaki, who always get bad public relations, mostly because of ancient aliens, unfortunately. not the best of shows. But if you look at the people who were behind them, they were very incredible sages and magicians. They were incredible people, but there's always this minority that always get all the attention. These people definitely were fighting amongst each other. They didn't always agree. I mean, look at the gods of Greece. They borrowed the stories from the Egyptians, essentially. But if you look at the gods of Greece, there's a lot of, intermarrying and, I just married my daughter and she's now the queen. That sounds a bit weird. So they didn't always get along, but somehow it worked. They didn't really have a religion per se, I don't think, according to the surviving texts. They just had the law of nature. They understood nature. They observed, they looked, and they said, that's a good thing. We can implement that, take the understanding of that, and build a nice temple out of it. And if you go back through history, you'll see that the beginning of any culture, any civilization, specifically in the Middle East, you'll see that at the beginning, at the center, there is the temple and the temple city. And that temple is a mirror of the perfection of the universe, of the perfection of nature. It has the harmonics, the geometry, the appreciation of stone. Everything is supposed to be a mirror of perfection. And the idea was that if people, even if they're, you know, idiots, if they stumble upon this incredible building, this incredible temple, and the perfection, they may not understand it, but something will just sort of seep into them. Mm. And they'll go, wow, I don't have to live among rubble and a rubbish-strewn hut. I can actually build something like that, and I bet I'd live a better life. That's how they did it. That was their religion. It was the religion of nature, of perfection, and they wanted everybody to be perfect. And so what they built would radiate out like ripples, and they would touch a lot of people, and it also created the complete opposite too, because someone would want to take it over or burn it down, but that's the way things are here on Earth. There's envy. Yeah. And that's one thing they also taught you, the seven deadly sins. In fact, in Egypt, there was 42 commandments. Right. Every morning, you'd look in the mirror and you go, I have not stolen. I have not taken my neighbor's wife. I have not taken my neighbor's ox. I have not deprived a baby from his mother's milk. I mean, it's incredible things.
Yeah.
Because it got narrowed down to 10 in the Bible. Yeah. But if you look at the original story of how every person had access to this information of, you know, being a righteous person, you could have the access to this every single day, and the idea was to make your life much better. That was their religion. It was completely based on the observation of nature.
And when did this start to become a bit more segregated and sort of,
ironically, with big earth changes? So around 2500 BC, we got hit with a lot of meteorites and a lot of plasma plasma emissions from the sun, massive sunspots, and the evidence is everywhere. The Chinese wrote about it extensively, and that's why they're obsessed with the sky. And you see a big temple building binge going on around the world, specifically in Europe. Stonehenge gets rebuilt. It went from a big circle to the trilithons. We have a massive building project around Europe, dolmens, giants' graves, everything. The pyramids were accentuated at that date as well, and they knew what was happening. So there was definitely an understanding that something was definitely going on. And actually, I've lost track of the question.
And when did sort of religious belief become a bit more segregated?
Right. So the climate went downhill. It's what happens after 50, you start losing track of things. the climate went downhill, and people began to be a bit more fearful about, where's my water coming from? The sunlight would be blocked out, crops weren't growing. So suddenly there was need. I need to grow crops, I need to feed myself. And you began to war with each other. And by 1300 BC, it's all over the Near East, the Middle East, in Europe. We were at the Bronze Age. That whole era was completely subjugated by a lot of rubbish coming out of the sky. There was another massive plasma event all over the Near East that took out the entire Bronze Age. So people became very fearful, they became possessive. Kind of like now with the water wars that are going on around the world. There's no water. We've run out of water. South Africa's having to import fresh water now. This is serious. So when there's an environmental degradation and there's no cooperation between people and you get into the fear, now you're going to start developing war, religion, possessiveness, politics, and so forth. All the wonderful things that we have today. So it comes out of fear, and that was the paradox here, is that the highest teaching in any of the mystery schools is to learn to control your fear. So one thing, I even teach that during my tours, the one thing that all of this is about is controlling the fear. If you can control the fear, there's reasoning fear. You don't stick your hands inside a tiger, it's going to hurt. But there's also unreasoning fear, most of it just based on nothing. It's just based on a perception, which is usually quite incorrect and lacks understanding and context. So if you understand and control your fear, there's nothing to fear. You don't have to fight with people over anything. Kind of like the toilet roll issue at the beginning of COVID. I mean,
Did you have that back in the US?
Oh, God, I came back. I'm the last person out of Cairo, the last flight to London. They got a 747 out of a hangar to take me to Boston with four people. It was fantastic. I could sit in first class.
Yeah.
And it was also my favorite plane. And I got home and where's the toilet paper? people just went mad. It's like, this is what I mean by fear. And all you have to do is say, okay, we have a problem. We're going to go into quarantine and I'll just buy what I need for now. Yeah. Next week, I'll go back to the store. It'll still be there.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. If you just get rid of that, society would be so much more harmonious.
Yeah.
More down to fear.
Yeah, despite what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So most people find the concept of Atlantis really, really intriguing. These pre-flood civilizations, is that, you know, what we know of as Atlantis? Is that how you would sort of describe? Are there links there? Are they, you know?
Yeah, my research kind of took me to the possibility that there were seven different landmasses on which the gods used to live. They always worked on the concept of seven plus an eight. Right. Gods that appear on the mainland after the flood are all in groups of seven sages with one charismatic leader. One was a woman who always happened to be the wisdom keeper, also happened to be the wife and sister of the charismatic leader. Okay. I'm sure there's a kind of a metaphor there. I don't think that was actually what was happening. But the idea was, and I found most of them now, and that's what essentially the book was all about. It was about looking for the missing lands, the ones that are now under the ocean, and a couple of them that behave like islands, which are now on the in the Bolivian altiplano, which is Lake Titicaca. That also, they had an island city there called Tiwanaku back at the end of the day, one of the oldest temple cities in the world. And so I worked out that they actually lived a society apart from most human beings. The gods kept themselves to themselves. So if you're going to be slightly more advanced than the people around you, you really don't want to mix around too much with them, because advanced understanding and barbarism, they don't make good bedfellows. Yeah. As we discovered, for example, in when anthropologists went to New Guinea about a decade or so ago, went on a trek into the mountains, and they accidentally bumped into a tribe of people who never even knew what clothing was. There was no hierarchy. They were all completely connected. Yeah. And it completely altered the outcome of the tribe. Suddenly, they went back a year later to find out, you know, through binoculars, what had we done to the tribe. And suddenly, they're wearing banana leaves, and I mean banana leaves, on their wrist. Wow. Because that's what the gods wore. And yeah, we now have clothing, because I'm now elevated. I'm now better than you, because I look like the gods. They completely distorted the development, the natural development of that tribe. So if these gods were so advanced, they would have known the same thing. They would have drip-fed the information of knowledge to humans, and that's how it was done. Drip-feed it, let them figure out things themselves and go back to our islands. Well, when the Younger Dryas collapsed, the problem was that their island sank 400 feet sea level. So Atlantis, which used to be called Atoll, was where the Azores are right now. And the story is actually in the annals of the Maya culture, and they actually have a date of 9600 BC when the gods arrive from Atoll, and they arrive on the Yucatan Peninsula, but with three gods. One was Quetzalcoatl, one was Kukulcan, and the other one that no one's ever heard of, it's Zama. He's the most interesting of all of them. So I've given him a whole chapter in the book, because he was presided over a group of people called the Itz, from where we get the word Chichen Itza from. It means magician priest. And they were the priests of Atlantis from Atoll in the middle of the Atlantic. And they said that, yeah, the thing collapsed. The entire Mid-Atlantic ridge collapsed in the blink of an eye. And then we had to hop from island to island, or stone to stone, they said, before reaching the Yucatan Peninsula. Well, the Egyptians have exactly the same story and exactly the same date. Now, Egypt is here, Yucatan is way over here. How do they have the same date and the same story? And the Egyptians said, actually, we came from a place from the south, at the island of fire. I don't know where it is. That's the only reference I have. Mm-hmm. Another one came from Iutiti, which means the island of the grandfather, which is the place of the ancestors. And it's a reference to Lake Titicaca, where we have the world's oldest temple city, where Viracocha and his seven sages happened to be going after the flood, because they escaped too. Now, the Pacific is full of these stories. I found one in New Zealand, a tribe called the Waitaha, who I adore, who were there thousands of years before the Maori. They just published their oral traditions, and I thought, I can't believe no one in New Zealand knows about this. This is incredible. They described the gods being in the middle of the flood. One of their boats didn't survive. They went back to New Zealand, to the birthplace of the gods, and I've been there six times. I can't get enough of it. It's like, you know, give me the drug. It's the most beautiful, beautiful landscape temple in the world. Beautiful. And I've done so much writing there. So that was one of their little homelands. And they said that before we went back to Easter Island, where they used to go backwards and forwards quite regularly, we used to go to a big land between there and South America called Kainga Nunui. And that disappeared in the flood. And I picked up the story in the Andes with the oldest culture there, the Puquina. They said, oh yeah, we still talk about this land that was there, a big island called La Puquiche. You call it Lemuria.
Right.
We don't know where Lemuria comes from, but that's what we call it, La Puquiche. And they still talk about it today. And it's all oral tradition. So there are these islands all around the world, in addition to Atlantis and Lemuria, where they lived. And the shape of the Earth changed dramatically at the end of the Younger Dryas. So we have no idea what this stuff is. But the biggest surprise was coming across the Wisdom Keeper, the last Wisdom Keeper of the Cook Islands. And not just the Cook Islands, the furthermost Cook Island, which you have to look on Google Earth. And if you're not looking carefully, you'll miss it. It's a tiny little island, about 3 feet above sea level. And I don't know how we got connected to each other. And he said, I'd be very privileged if you could tell my people's oral tradition, because I'm the last guy. I said, I'd be happy to publish this for you. And I said, I'm looking for the flood. I said, well, there was a group of people that came here about 5,000 years ago. And I said, well, that's not the period I'm looking for. And he says, well, be quiet for a second. It's a long story. And he said, they were called the Tupanaki. And I said, wait a minute, that sounds like Anunnaki. He said, yeah, you called them the Anunnaki. They used to come here on ships from the Middle East 5,000 years ago. There was already a home here when there's a lot. We had a lot more land mass. I thought, wow. But how does that communicate to the big flood 11,000 years ago? I said, well, they used to live on this island in the middle of the Indian Ocean, which is gone. It was called Te Pitaka. I said, well, where is it? You'll never find it. It's under the ocean. There's sediment. If you drill far enough, you might find it. But it's kind of roughly now where the Arabian Peninsula happens to be, because something went down and something went up. There's a quid pro quo. So that's why all that sand in the middle of the desert in Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, is there. The ocean literally just drained that way, and it created an uplift, and that's what we have. And you can still see it from the sky. It's still that sort of dredge of water that goes towards the Indian Ocean. So somewhere around there is the seventh home of the gods. So yeah, they're all lived on islands everywhere.
Amazing. And where would you go if you could uncover one of these places, you know, dig it up from the ocean? Where would you go?
I don't know. I'm not a good underwater person. I'll leave that to Graham Hancock. I think he actually done a very good assessment of that. And he's also got a lot of backing and a lot of research assistance. So he writes quicker than I do. we have a joke about it once in a while. And we're following kind of a parallel story. I talk more about the people, he talked more about the evidence about lost civilization. He does it very well.
Yeah.
And so I'll leave that up to him. No, if there's one place I would dig up, if suddenly I won the lottery tomorrow with $30 million, I would go to Egypt and dig up the town where the Egyptian god of wisdom, Jehuti, who you know better by the Greek name, Thoth, that was his hometown. And we've never found all the books that he wrote. We found two of them, and they're in fragments. They're written on the walls of the Temple of Edfu. And there was a wonderful woman who's passed away now at Manchester University called Eve Raymond, who deciphered that wall. And my God, I mean, the book is like £300. It's bloody expensive. There's not many copies of it. I thought, I want to find the other books that Jehuti wrote. I would pay people, the local people, double the going rate to help me dig up the mud. I'm sure it's still there somewhere. People talk about the Emerald Tablets of Thoth. This is kind of the where it comes from, although a lot of it is fragmented. I want to go back and find the original stuff, because it talks about the specifications of the sacred mound. I thought, oh, wouldn't I love to know the specification, how to build a perfect temple.
Despite
that, and that's about the stories that they've inherited over tens of thousands of years, because their traditions go back to 39,000 BC. That's when the first pharaoh of what would become Egypt takes the throne.
Right.
39,000 BC. And it's written on a papyrus. So imagine the treasure trove that you find from digging that up. Mm-hmm. That's what I would like to do.
Fantastic. Well, I'll keep my fingers crossed. If you win the lottery,
Saturday. Oh, actually, I've got time. I can go buy a ticket. Yeah. I'll let you know. And then I'll have proposals of marriage from everywhere.
So I have a question about language for you. Modern language, I think, isn't so helpful. It's kind of descriptive, isn't it? But it's always seemed like these ancient languages, they're more syllabic. They're more like encoded energy. Do you know what I mean? It seems like they're more vibrational in nature as opposed to, you know, the
language that
we have. Do you think were languages like that used, first of all, by the pre-flood civilizations? And do you think it was more helpful to have a language like that in terms of what they were trying to achieve and things like that?
Oh, absolutely. And they've made a lot of points about discussing language in the early Egyptian era. Again, going back to Jehuti, he came in one day into the meeting with the gods, and he was a god himself. And he said, look, aren't I really clever? I discovered writing. And the god said, and I'm actually trying to quote from the actual extract. They said, well, you are indeed incredibly bright. You know about the stars, you know about mathematics, and now you've invented language. But be careful, Jehuti, because humans will take language and distort it, because words are an approximation of the truth of things. That's why we communicate with sound. And the sound of the language, the sound of the word, is much more important. It's close to the truth. But true communication is by the sound. It's the vibration of things. So there were some studies that were done in the oldest languages in the world, which is ancient Hebrew, Sanskrit, old Javanese, and there's another one that escapes me. It'll get to me. And they talked about how these are, and especially in Sanskrit, they are described as the vestiges of the words of God. Mm-hmm. So the phrasings of the actual letters contain a certain mathematical formula and a certain harmonic formula which communicates the truth. So to the point where if you try to distort Sanskrit, you'll have your hands chopped off. That's a law in India still. And also, when you transpose that to raga, which is the Indian sacred music upon which Sanskrit is based, so you're taking vibration and creating language out of it, the notes of raga cannot be altered either. You'll be shot. So they're very serious about it. And there have been studies that have been done that show that when you actually put the scripted languages, for example, Old Hebrew, into tetrahedral shapes and throw a light through it, Stan Tenen, I believe, is the guy who did the work on this years ago. He said that you can actually create the motions of the entire universe, or the spiral motions, the mathematical codes upon which life is created. So I believe there's some truth to this, because today language is used for, oh my God, like, okay, it's used for, easy communication, but it means nothing.
Yeah.
It's like listening to music on an MP3 file. It's horrible. I thought I listened to the album. And you go, I can feel that, but I'm hearing the music, but I can't feel it. I can hear on an LP or a CD, which is already compressed. And it's the same with language. Language has become compressed. And I always joke with people, if you're looking for a good Christmas present, buy someone the Oxford English Book of Etymology from, say, 1820. And just from them, you'll see how much of the English language has either been distorted or has gone altogether.
Yeah.
You know, words like sonorous, that's a very sonorous description. I mean, that says so much about what you're describing. It's like, oh, that's nice. Yeah, we've lost so much of that language, and we're using it just for cheap communication nowadays, for convenience. Back then, it meant something. If your name named your child that's about to come out of the mother's womb, Tutankhamun, it means something. It means that you are the eternal image of God, and that baby has to live up to that image. Yeah. It didn't just choose words willy-nilly, like, you know, Bob, Kev, Fred, whatever. They went back and said the soul of this child is the eternal image of God. That would be his name. And you lived up to that, and he gave you a platform, a spiritual platform upon which to, you know, move your life. So we've lost so much of that. So that's why I always tell people, get the etymological book, read big things. And in fact, in a lot of my books, the last one, not so much. I was in a bit of a hurry to write it, actually. You know, I've also spent the year on 67 airplanes, so it feels a bit rushed. But I always get hate mail in a good way every single time I release a book, because I'll say, you know, you bastard, every chapter that you write, there's one word I have to go and look up in a dictionary. I can't find it. So, well, you're not using the Oxford English Dictionary of 1848, where the words come from. And I do that deliberately to force people to pay attention, to look and stop and listen to what I'm trying to say, because there's a story behind the story that I've written. And then there's two books in there. There's the visual book, and then there's the magic. There's the understanding between the words. And I love using that. And I mean, I'm Portuguese by birth, so, and a lot of my English friends say, you know, you've got a marvelous command of the English language. I said, yeah, because I have to try harder, because I came there when I was 8. I had to fight for my survival in school. You know, you get beaten up for being a Dago. You're not like one of us. You already look suntan, and it's only January. So, you know, people who have to fight that, they develop that language. So, and I'm very happy to be a dual citizen. So it makes me very happy. But yeah, it's important to go back to the origin of words. You know, read Oscar Wilde, read anything from pre-Victorian era to get a sense of just how much we've lost in Britain.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Absolutely. And those older languages, do you think that helped them become more civilized, become more developed, so that they're expressing the truth of everything, aren't they? Generational way. Yeah.
It gave them a foundation. It didn't necessarily change it, but it gave them the foundation. You know, here is the goalpost.
Yeah.
Do you want to kick the ball for the goalpost? And some people say, yeah, I want to kick the goal for the goalpost because I can look more elegant and more civilized. I don't want to be, you know, knuckle drugging through the streets, drunk all my life. So you have the choice, it's put in front of you. Whether you choose to take it or not, it's a personal decision.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so what can we learn from these pre-flood civilizations that will help us become a better civilization now? So are there specific things that they did that we can kind of try and embody or to try and remember to uncover?
Yeah, the 42 commandments of the Egyptians, it's all there. There's nothing really new in that respect. I mean, we talk about the new age and the new coming. It's actually the old age. The stuff that I've read about new age and new age thinking, it's actually very old. If you read old texts and old traditions, this has been done before in a different language, but to the same end. You don't steal from people. You try to do the best you can every day. The fact that you're here on earth, incarnated, means you're not perfect. So don't put the world on your shoulder. Don't keep blaming yourself for getting it wrong. If you were perfect, you would have had the common sense to incarnate. This is difficult. It hurts. Bloody hard work. I mean, there are fringe benefits, but, you know, like sushi and the jazz. Yeah. But, Tintin books. and other things I won't mention on air, which are quite nice. But no, that was the whole point. It's about how to behave in a better way towards yourself. That's what the gods were doing. They were looking at nature and saying, nature's perfect. We don't have to be better than that. We can respect that and be better people. And while we're here in the body, we can go through this ridiculous experience and do the best we can. Because when we die, we go back to the collective and we go, hey, you know, I did as best as I could and I've improved myself each time. And now I'm going to have another experience as something else. Because that's the secret of the universe, everybody. The whole point of living is to have the experience and to learn from it. And then when you go back into your spirit world, you go, that was interesting. I think I kind of understood that, or I didn't quite get that right. I think I need to go and fix that. Because at the end of it, God is trying to know itself through us, who we're all gods too. It's trying to perfect itself, even though, and here's the paradox, it already is perfect. So we'll never get ahead around this. It's too hard to comprehend, so don't go there. So the idea is to be a god, to be a civilizing influence, is to conduct yourself in life in a positive way. Make a difference, make a positive difference, help others, don't steal, don't lie, don't covet thy neighbor's wife, which George Harrison would have agreed with me, sorry, George.
He'll be back.
Exactly. He's probably come back as Eric Clapton's guitar and he'll break down. But even he made peace with him. I mean, that was his Buddhist teachings that, you know, I'm going to accept this. A bigger story here. Of course, I'm speaking out of turn, but I think there's a bigger story here. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to forgive and I'm going to embrace the man who took my wonderful wife. I mean, that's a wonderful way of overcoming a huge personal injury and personal hurt. I'm not sure I have that capacity. I'm working towards it. This is a hard thing sometimes. I think that's a wonderful example of a person who actually tried to teach that. So that's all we have to do. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. They already did that for us. They tried to show us. They left us the instructions. And now we just have to keep looking at the wheel when we forget where the wheel is and what the wheel actually looks like. But it's sitting all around us. It's sitting in all the temples around the world. Just go and stand in a Gothic cathedral. Go to Wells Cathedral in England. And walk in, and the whole thing is built on sonic resonance, by the way. But the one place most people don't see, you go towards the northeast quadrant up this wonderful flight of stairs. It looks like the Golden Ratio. The stairs are beautifully worn. There's a chapter house in there. And one day I should write a book on that little chapter house. It's one of the most perfect buildings in the entire universe.
Right.
Acoustics are extraordinary. You can't conduct a conversation in there The official story is absolute nonsense, by the way, of what they did in that. You can't talk to one to the other because the design, the geometry and the acoustics break down any vocal expression. You have to tone in there. All you have to do is very quietly, and all the sound goes around like this. And after 2 hours, you realize you've been there for 2 hours and you're totally out of your head.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful location. So we have these self-help centers to connect you back with the nature of things and the connection of yourself. And you feel much better after a visit to the chapter house as well, believe me.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So we're shifting into a new paradigm here on Earth. So moving forward, how would you like to see this information that you've uncovered be sort of integrated?
Oh, go to my website, buy my books, get my DVDs. No, I mean, the idea is to be that information. You can't. I'm always amazed by how many people I see at my conferences after 20 years. And I love them. Some of them I got to know quite well. They're great friends. But they keep saying, well, when is the shift going to happen? And when is the information? We've been giving you the information for 20 years. I'm the next generation of people who came before me, who are my teachers, who I adore. And they were here teaching the same thing, using slightly different words. I'm just following in their footsteps, trying to tell you what I learned to become a better person, hoping that you're going to be a better person. And you're still buying every book that isn't nailed to the bookshelf, and you still haven't practiced it. You've got to be the change you wish to see, okay? Yeah. Or as the Hopi said, you're the one you've been waiting for. It's all there. The information is there. The temples are there. The information is all around you, but you have to practice it. You have to apply it. One of the things that I do, and this is after many years of observation, is can we take a temple and put it in the living room? And I found that actually you can. I'm sitting in one right now. If you can see it, I'll give you $1 million. You can't. It's very carefully hardwired into the structure of this room. I'm sitting on one of the Earth's tellurian currents right now. It's the only place in the entire area where there's a current of energy and the only place where I can put my desk in the entire building.
Right.
There's a reason for this. I am feeding off the energy and I'm feeding it back. This is what you have to do. So I've actually taught people a method to build sacred space in their own houses, living room, or even a piece of land. Create portals everywhere so that you can help yourself connect with the final line of things. I've just finished 6 commissions this week to build temples inside people's homes across the world this week. Bit tired, moving energy remotely, doing geometry and get people to say, okay, you're going to put this around your house. You're going to bury this under the foundation. They're going, absolutely. And within days, like, you won't believe what just happened. So try me. There's a lady in England, I just did some work for on her house from here, just moved all the negative energy out of the area. And I said, just leave the building for 6 hours because you don't want to be there when stuff is moving.
Yeah.
And she says, for the first time in a year, I've been able to sleep. Everything's shifted around here. What have you done? I said, well, I can tell you. You can do it. Yeah. And that's why I put these modalities out, for you to apply to make your life much more connected to nature. That's what it comes down to. It's connecting you to nature, to the universe, to the perfection of everything around you. And again, COVID, that's the one thing that's come out of COVID, is the fact that you have time, if you can afford it, and I hope you can, to go out in nature. And Britain has wonderful nature, some of the best in the world. And that's what I miss the most, the footpaths, getting out there. Yeah. And connecting and just listening to what the universe is trying to say. Get out of the head and go home and go, hey, I just had a great idea. Boom, it just happened. The universe just downloaded something. And, of course, you take credit for it and your guides are going, hey, how about some credit over here? The information. And it's important to always honour those people that support you. And there's a lot of people supporting us, by the way.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, so if this has sparked something in someone listening, where can they find out more? So you've got books, your guide.
Oh, website, my ridiculous website.
Yeah.
Invisibletemple.com. There's a reason why it's called that, because it's about the invisible temple, not the one that you see. So there's all my books are there. There are all the DVDs. There's tons of articles. You can also register to join Gaia and watch Gaia, all the programs on Gaia, Save Yourself a Fortune, stuff like that. So there's a lot of help stuff in there that's involved. And also there's a tour page for people if you want to come on one of the tours. In fact, we're about to go to the Yucatan in late January if you want to get away from winter. We have a lovely time. It's a very easy trip. Back to Egypt again, late February. Peru, the Andes, that's a stressful one. You've got to be very physically fit to do the Peruvian tour, but my God, you lose so much weight. Okay. And you don't want to go home at the end of it, but you've had such a great time. It's a very raw energy in the end, really raw. You're going to really like it. But the fringe benefits are fantastic. So that's where you'll find it all.
Okay, brilliant. And so what exciting things have you got coming up? So you're doing some tours, you're working on some new projects.
Yeah, that was lunch. pint of all speckled hen.
Right.
I've always got a couple of projects going on. I never know. I don't plan this stuff. It just happens by itself. There's something just suddenly appears. I go, oh, that's interesting. I think I'll follow that and see where it goes. And boom, you know, 5 years later, there's a book. So you have to be patient for books to come out. I'm working on a new DVD, a documentary about Orion as the origin of civilization. I'm still doing the research for it. So hopefully that'll either come out in about a month. And then Gaia, they're usually 8 months behind schedule because they have so many people that they have to cater to. There's always something going on. I'm going to look more into each book. The ending of each book gives me the idea of what's going to happen next. So you just never know.
And that's really, it sounds like you're really sort of on your path. It's, you know, you just think you're just popping into your reality and you know.
It's always difficult. It's a difficult life. It's a lonely life. It really is. I don't recommend it for everybody, but the fringe benefits are great. And by which I mean, you lose a lot of friends. You lose marriages, you lose houses. Everyone that I know that's got involved in this has gone through the ringer. They really have.
Yeah.
You come out of it a better person, I think, much more sort of fine-tuned. And I think I'm not the same person that I was 20 years ago. I've made huge improvements. And it's a constant, you know, it's a work in progress. And that's the best you can do. but it is challenging. But I feel very, I feel like someone's looking after me all the time. I think there's a God that protects stupid tourists. And I'm one of them. And then whatever happens, when I look back at the moments where things have shifted in an incredible dramatic fashion, I recognize what's happened around me. And I know who my guides are. I see them a lot in certain places, and other people see them too. It's not just me making it up. They can see what I can see as well. They're very interesting people, very tall. And so I'm very guided by them. I have that trust. They have my back all the time. I've never been let down. And the temples never let me down. So I feel that I'm on a certain path, tripping over things once in a while. But, you know, you trip over so you can get up again and do it better. So it's a constant process of refinement, you know. And to become a polished diamond, having started that as a rough stone, that's the best you can do. You know, and keep a sense of humor as well, because otherwise you go mad.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic.
And if not, just drink heavily.
Get some old speckled hen.
Oh, God, I missed a pub.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Freddie Silver. Thank you for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy your lunch.
My love to Cornwall and the rest of Britain.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.